Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of January. The Third Way is a centrist Democratic group, and one of the honorary chairs of this organization is Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who, as you know, has been concerned for some time about the level of civility or lack of civility among elected representatives. On Monday of this week, this group sent a letter to congressional leaders outlining some ideas of how to promote civility in Congress and to achieve more moderation in the discourse, political discourse in this country. They have made some suggestions. They include bipartisan seating in the House chamber for President Obama's State of the Union address to avoid the spectacle of one side jumping up to applaud while the other side sits stone-faced with hands in laps. They also suggested a bipartisan retreat for each chamber of Congress. The parties, as you know, often hold separate retreats, and they confer with each other on policy issues, party priorities, and other matters. And the group also proposed a cultural exchange program by which lawmakers could make regular visits to the home states or districts of a member of the opposing party. How do we achieve civility? How do we achieve moderation on this day that memorial service will take place in Tucson and the president will address the nation on this important issue? We address the issue this hour of the program. Our guest is Sean Gibbons. Sean is Director of Communications for the Third Way. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Sean, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to everybody out there listening.
Tell me about Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' involvement with the organization. She's an honorary co-chair?
That's correct. Congresswoman Giffords serves as an honorary co-chair. We have six members in the House and six senators who serve as honorary co-chairs, and effectively what that means is we often confer with them on policy ideas that we're developing. We've been characterized in the media. I just want to correct something real quickly.
Sure.
We've been characterized in the media as a group. I like to think of the Beatles or the Rolling Stones as a group. we are a think tank. So we develop policy ideas, and one of the things that we do with our co-chairs is we try to, an idea is only as good as the impact that it ultimately has. And so we frequently will work with our co-chairs to try to see if it's possible for them to take those ideas, potentially craft them into legislation, and move the national debate conversation forward.
Are you concerned as the Third Way about the level of civility in this country?
I'm concerned about it not necessarily just as a staffer here at Third Way. We just, again, another little correction. We don't use the for whatever reason. But at Third Way, we're concerned about it. But even just as a citizen, I think I'm concerned about it. The level and tone of the national conversation has gotten so polarized that it's off-putting to many Americans. I think one thing people seem to forget sometimes is that the plurality of American voters out there self-describe as moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that hasn't changed in literally 30 years. And those are the folks who, some people refer to them as swing voters, but by and large, these are folks who find a lot of this process just terribly, terribly off-putting. And certainly what we've seen over the last several months seems to have borne that out a little bit.
You have policy papers and you're working on issues concerning economics, national security, culture, domestic policy, clean energy, and you draft and market issue papers and reports on all of these issues. Are there certain stands that you take that set you apart from everybody else?
Well, I think, in fairness to your listeners, it's probably worth noting that we are a center-left think tank in Washington these days. It seems that everybody needs to have some sort of place along the political spectrum. And so, as such, I think we are, if folks are familiar with the Center for American Progress, where I previously worked, CAP tends to take positions that are sometimes a little bit to the left of where we end up. Our overarching aim is to try to convince policymakers in the nation's capital that we really need to focus on creating economic growth over the next. That has to be the singular focus of national policymakers over the next many dozen years. We feel like a lot of the work that's animated, in particular the Democratic Party, has been about expanding the social safety net, and we think that that's important and really critical work. But if we're going to be able to fund that safety net, if we're going to be able to pay for things like Social Security and Medicare, we need to really figure out how to grow the economy in a real and meaningful way. One of the things we look at with some concern is that current growth projections for the nation's economy are around 2%. If that happens, we're going to be in a position of, in the not-too-distant future, looking at really having to triage the federal budget and make significant and perhaps really devastating cuts to folks who could least afford to take those kinds of cuts in those programs.
And, Sean, is it private sector growth that you're looking at, or do you see a role for government to spark the economy?
We think that whenever the economy grows, it's always because there's typically a partnership between the government and private industry. The government's obviously perhaps the single largest consumer in our economy, and so they're a critical element of it, but also setting priorities. Look, tax policy has an impact on the business community, as does simply an emphasis. The bully pulpit sometimes is incredibly important in signaling to folks where they should be investing and how we can create growth. So for our part on issues like energy, we think it's incredibly important that that the Congress appropriate money to put their money where their mouth is on trying to solve issues around the climate change question.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of policies do you have on energy? Is this part, we've talked on this show before, about whether or not the green revolution, the green economy, is where we're going to see economic growth in this country. Is that where we will see it? Do we need to stimulate that sector of the economy in some way?
Absolutely. Look, I think whenever you talk to economists, one of the things they frequently look to is massive leaps forward, that the American economy doesn't seem to grow at sort of a steady pace. So one example I could offer you is economists back in the late 70s projected out growth for the United States, and they compared it to the United States or to Japan and Germany. And at the time, they were anticipating that Germany and Japan's economies would grow something on the order of about 8 to 10% annually, which was just tremendous growth, while the United States would probably move along at a much more modest pace of about 3% growth. That was true, as a matter of fact. It turned out that Japan and Germany grew like gangbusters. But what economists couldn't have anticipated was that two things happened in the 90s that not only caught the United States up economically, but actually vaulted us ahead of both of those economies. And those two things were the internet and the technology boom that happened in the early 90s, and then the biotechnology boom that happened towards the end of the 90s. Those two huge waves of innovation had a profound impact on growing our economy. And so one of the things we think about is that the clean energy sector is a huge opportunity. It's a $2 trillion global market. And clearly, as countries not only here in the United States but around the world look to shift how they're producing and consuming energy, we think that it's absolutely critical that folks in the United States have the opportunity to build those things that they're going to need to generate that energy.
I've heard that China really has the lead in this area. Is that true?
I think, actually, if you went on our website, one of my colleagues here, Bill Rapp, has built a graphic that, you know, starkly illustrates that question. China has actually, at this point, just eaten our lunch on clean energy investments. And the truth of the matter is, I'm just pulling the thing up now so I can give you accurate information, but the public and private investments in clean energy in the United States just in the year 2009, so going back 2 years, U.S. spent $21 billion on clean energy, which sounds like a significant amount of money until you compare it to China, where China spent $114 billion in clean energy. And of that, $80 billion came from the Chinese government, and then the private sector, such as it is in China, contributed another, I think it is about $35 billion.
Do you see a lot of controversy between a political left and a political right, or whatever phrases we want to use these days?
Do I see it?
No. Do you see controversy about energy policy among politicians?
You know, my biggest worry is not that there's controversy. It's that, at least on the energy question, is that there doesn't seem to be an appetite to work on this issue.
Right. I agree.
So I think apathy is actually my biggest concern. Mm.
And why? Why is there apathy?
You know, I think on some level, there's different questions around the country. One of the things we're struggling with here at the think tank we're working on right now is what could be a potential plan B for energy? Because clearly we had an idea that moved through the Congress. Chairman Markey did a tremendous job, and so did Chairman Waxman, of moving a climate bill through the House of Representatives, and a bunch of congressmen took really tough votes to pass that bill. When it got to the Senate, it was unable to move, and that's unfortunate. what we keep asking ourselves is, why did that happen? And one of the things we think has occurred here is that there's just huge regional differences. So, for instance, in Wisconsin, the sorts of ways that you might produce alternative energy are very different than the way a state like, well, one that's been in the news recently, Arizona, would produce
right.
energy. It's very different than the way Massachusetts might produce mm-hmm. alternative energy. So we think that actually a plan B for energy might be something that includes something that we call a clean energy standard. So rather than something that has been very much in vogue, particularly among folks in the environmental space, which is the idea of a renewable energy standard, we think we need to expand the conversation and sort of have an all-of-the-above strategy, which means that if you live in Alabama, maybe nuclear power, which is clean energy, is a part of a component of your energy solution. That might not make sense in a place like Maine, where you potentially have opportunities to use wind or hydropower in new and innovative ways. And it might not make sense in a place like Arizona, where you might be able to, as we make more and more breakthroughs in solar, use solar power or geothermal power. So we think that it's really critical that we really sort of focus on energy rather than as a national sort of policy, as a national policy that's mindful of the regional differences around the country.
So what do we have to do? Wait for gasoline to hit $4.50 a gallon, $4 a gallon?
Gosh, I don't know about you, but the $3 a gallon is hurting my wallet pretty badly.
Right.
I'm not entirely clear on what it's going to take. The fact is, there's not a lot of political will in Washington to take this issue up. And it's for our part, it's sort of baffling because we really do believe this is an opportunity for it to have a real economic driver. And I don't want to make people think that I sound terribly skeptical or cynical on this issue. I'm hopeful. I actually think that there's going to be the possibility in this next Congress to have some pretty serious conversations about it. If I'm being completely frank, I'm not sure it's going to happen in the next 6 months, but I hope that it's going to happen over the next 8 to 9 months.
Let's go to an email that's come in, and we'll welcome phone calls. I know that many of our listeners will want to speak to these issues. Some issues, Sean, are so polarizing, abortion and guns, immigration, we could add. How can we have calm debate? How do we deal with very strong opinions that are held on those issues that don't seem to have a middle ground?
So at Third Way, we actually have something which I think is somewhat innovative for a think tank. We have something that we call the Culture Program, because we acknowledge the fact that there are these huge debates out there on what we think of as sort of cultural issues, which includes guns and religion and abortion, all those things that Mom told you never to talk about at the
right.
table. We think that what really is critical, and this is something the president, we're delighted to see him sort of working towards this, is we can't necessarily ask people to put aside their beliefs. But what we can say is, why don't we find places where maybe we might find common ground? Clearly, people who are engaged on an issue like abortion, for instance, I know that's obviously a tinderbox of an issue. Clearly, people who have strong feelings on that issue are engaged on that issue. They spend a lot of time thinking about it. They spend a lot of time advocating for their position wherever they may fall on the spectrum on that question. What we think is really critical is not acknowledging the fact that they deeply, deeply care, and then asking, where are some places where we might be able to actually find common ground? So, for instance, one of my former colleagues, Rachel Lazar, did a tremendous amount of work talking about a common ground abortion policy, something the White House actually ended up pushing forward a little bit, which was this idea that most people believe that are very, very troubled by the question of abortion. Even folks who support abortion rights tend to question it, and they think it's a difficult situation for an individual who has to go through the situation. So the question was, could we potentially make abortions less common and offer more support for women who actually move through with their pregnancies, while at the same time protecting the right for those people who choose to have it for whatever reason they choose? We think that there's ways to find common ground. Look, let me be very frank. It tends to get a little complicated when we're asking people to move into a space where they have very strongly held beliefs. But we think that's the only way we sort of move forward as a country, is if we actually ask people who sometimes disagree where they can sort of look to their left and look to their right and find something common with their fellow citizens.
Now let's pick an issue that is highly contentious, we think about it more this week because of the horrors of Arizona, and that is guns. We have very different ideas in this country about what kinds of guns should be sold, particularly whether or not the kind of gun, which evidently the number of people who bought them went up significantly.
The Glocks, yeah, I saw that.
So how do we deal with that issue? Because that one's highly contentious, and talk about people holding to whatever their viewpoint is. Either don't touch any guns; it's an infringement on the Second Amendment, or people who have a completely opposite viewpoint. We need guns for hunting and maybe in the house for self defense, but nothing more than that.
Sure. Well, first, I mean, I think one of the things that shocks me that I saw just this week. In fact, one of my colleagues is one of the preeminent experts on gun policy here in Washington, Jim Kessler. And he said to me, you know, most people don't realize we have 250 million guns. And that's an estimate because we actually, with all the straw purchases and under-the-table trades for guns, we simply don't know how many guns are actually out there in circulation. But we have roughly, the estimates are, about 250 million firearms that are in circulation in the United States. Most of those are privately held by families, and most of those are probably held by people who hunt or are using them for protection by legal means. But it's really shocking when you think of a nation of 300 million or whatever the new census number is, that we have 250 million firearms, so we don't have more situations like the ones we saw in Arizona. That said, you know, I think most gun owners out there believe in gun safety, and I think that's probably going to be the place where we're going to have the conversations. Is it possible to ensure the people who legally want to possess and own a firearm and are going to do so in a responsible way can own those firearms, but we can also ensure that people like this unfortunate soul in Tucson, Jared Loughner, never are able to get their hands on a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a kid who spent time in jail for drug offenses and clearly had been written up for some concerns about his mental health, and yet he was able to walk into a store and purchase a weapon literally that very same day. I think it was an instantaneous check. We're going to have a serious conversation in this country about whether we think that's a good idea. That's the kind of country we want to be in the 21st century.
Right. We have to fashion some kind of make sure that people like that don't fall through the crack, which may be difficult to do. We're going to welcome phone calls. I want to also talk about this letter that was written to Congress on Monday of this week. What about the idea of, and we're getting close to the State of the Union address, instead of Republicans sitting on one side, Democrats on the other, that they mix it up so that you don't have one side applauding and the other side sitting stoically, that you have people together in the body. Is that symbolic, and is that a good idea? And they have other suggestions that were sent to the Honorable John Boehner, the Honorable Harry Reid, Speaker Majority Leader, and the Honorable Nancy Pelosi, the Honorable Mitch McConnell. Maybe we should just call each other honorable, too. That would be a change. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and our guest this first hour of the program is Sean Gibbons. He is Director of Communications for the Third Way. You're probably familiar with the fact that Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is honorary chair of the Third Way. Think it's not the Third Way, it's Third Way, sorry. Think tank that was formed, I think, about 5 years ago in Washington, looking for moderation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl is joining us the second hour of our program today to give us recommendations of great reads for 2011. She reads and remembers what she has read more than any other human being I know. And she has just been received another honor, Librarian of the Year, for her extraordinary contribution to the world of reading. She will be with us, hour number two of our program. And we do want to tell you, for those who like to read and like to read history, we do a lot of history programs here. We're going to be speaking with Ron Chernow, who's written the longest biography of George Washington. And he will be with us tomorrow to talk about our first president. Washington, A Life is the name of the book, and it's obviously a very, very thorough account of George Washington's entire life from the moment he was born until the moment that he died. We're having a few problems with our computer here. I'm very sorry, because this is an important issue, and we hope to get phone calls, but I hope that we'll have it worked out momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. Keep that number in mind, and we'll get this worked out, I'm sure, as soon as we can. What about this idea of bipartisan seating in the House of Representatives? That strikes me as a great idea. Have you heard from anybody you sent the letter to on Monday, Sean?
You know, I, as a general policy, we try to keep our conversations with members of Congress, our private conversations, private. Suffice to say, we've been talking with a number of folks up on the Hill, and I think your listeners would probably be pleased with the kinds of the tenor of those conversations.
Uh-huh. Wouldn't that be a change to watch it on television and not see the usual one side, the other side?
I tell you, you know, we don't think of it as a groundbreaking idea. There's plenty of things that we deal with that are sort of thorny issues. It starts as a sort of a plain white T-shirt of an idea, one of those ones that everybody should be able to sort of look at and just say, gosh, why don't we do that? Why not?
Right. Let's take phone calls. We got things worked out here now. Scott from La Crosse, your first caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
I'm glad to be able to get through. A while back, you were on a vacation, and While you were gone, the fill-in host had a guest on who had written a book about the massacre at Wounded Knee. And what her point was, or what she elucidated in her interview, and I had no idea of this, was that she said that the end of the 19th century was a period very analogous to what we're going through right now, in that the Republican and Democrat parties were not just opponents. They actually thought the other was evil, and the hatred was running probably about as deep as it is now. And she said that this, and of course, again, I think there's another analogy because the corporations were running both parties as well. And I hadn't really ever heard that it had been that way at that time. But it got me to thinking, well, around that same time, we see a couple of things happening. One is the Grange movement starts up, where the farmers who were basically being ripped off by the railroads, feeling so alienated, started forming their own political movement. And in addition, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, the progressive movement was actually, those were Republicans. You know, La Follette was not a Democrat. He was a Republican. But there again, it was a reaction to the fact that there was all this animosity between the two major parties, and the regular people in the country were feeling like, well, what about us? You know, all we see are these people calling each other, you know, evil and worrying about the fate of the Republic if the other gets control of the Congress or the White House. And what are they doing about our issues? And I'm wondering if Sean there feels that maybe we've got an analogous situation, and are they looking at what went on in that period, what those folks did to try and get some political grassroots sowed and get things like the antitrust acts and those kind of things through a very divided and hostile legislature?
Hi, Scott. Yeah, thanks for your question. Well, you know, I am actually a bit of a student of progressive history since I work at nominally a progressive think tank. I think the word means something very different than what it meant perhaps back in the 19th century. You're right. I mean, the progressive movement at the end of the 19th century was a moderate movement. It was, we didn't have a robust middle class the way we did today, but it was a middle class movement. It was people saying they were disgusted by the sort of polarization of our politics and ended up having a very, very effective 20 or 30-year period where they were one of the dominant forces in American life. I would actually recommend, if you're looking for a book recommendation, there's a book called America Afire, which is about the election of 1800 between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And what you'd find in that book is that, unfortunately, the level of discourse has been pretty heated for virtually our entire history as a republic. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you have heard of the Sedition Act, but that actually came out of the 1800 election, where folks who were acting as journalists for either the Whig Party or in the Federalist Party were actually thrown into jail for writing editorials or publishing things that were considered libelous about the sitting president, who at that time was John Adams. So worth a read. It's a good read, and unfortunately, it does suggest that that we have always had a rather robust, perhaps that's the right way to put it, conversation here in the United States. Are we at a moment where, to answer your question, are we at a moment where folks could potentially look to move forward, really significantly shift the tenor and tone of our politics, and also change some of the policies so that we really catch up, move in the direction we need to move over the next, decade or two as we evolve into the 21st century? I'm certainly hopeful of that. There are some groups that have emerged recently. There's a group called No Labels that Mayor Bloomberg of New York and a number of folks on both sides of the aisle, including my boss, John Cowan, have had a hand in creating, which is meant to be a grassroots movement that seeks this very sort of conversation going forward, which is, I think, their tagline is something that's relatively illuminating. It's not left, right forward. And that's certainly where we sort of believe that the conversation needs to go. We have just too many challenges facing us as a nation. We live in a globalized world that's very different than the one that we lived in even 20 years ago. Frankly, I'm not sure that bickering amongst ourselves is doing us a heck of a lot of good, given some of the challenges and opportunities that are in front of us.
I'm sure rooting for you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Great.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks very much for the call. I'm wondering, given media and the way that it fuels a certain kind of debate, there's nothing wrong with robust debate and people getting angry with each other and having different ideas and spirited conversation and very different ideas about the way to get things done. But it seems that we're on a different kind of level here now, where there isn't this, well, I think you have an idea that maybe I hadn't thought of before that might be an interesting idea. And I'm wondering, when you have people so polarized and the press fueling a lot of this, I think, how do you achieve dignified conversations that are robust?
You know, I actually think we have somebody here in Washington who's trying to do that very thing. President Obama, on a number of occasions, one of the things I like an awful lot about this president is that he keeps his word. He has, throughout the conversation he's been having with the American people since 2008, said that I don't care where an idea comes from. If it's a good idea, it's going to help the country, it's going to help Americans move forward, then let's have a conversation about it. Let's figure out how to implement it, see if we can do it. That, to me, is the exact way that we want our presidents to be having conversations with us. We don't want them to act as hyper-partisans. So I think, there's no way to ultimately control the way the national conversation occurs. It's an organic thing. I think we all know from our personal lives, sometimes the squeaky wheels are the ones that get greased. That certainly seems to be the case in some of the really hyper partisan debates that we have over issues that really ought to be things we should be thinking about, how to fix the problems, as opposed to who can complain the loudest and who can sully the reputation of their opponent the most.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Scott, as always, for your call. Sandy in Algoma, hi.
Hi. Actually, you know what, I had a whole train of thought here, but just listening to your guest talk about Obama, I'm not sure where he gets it from that he's keeping his word on anything. He hasn't kept his word on anything. And that's very frustrating that he just said that, because I'm not sure where he's getting his information from. In any case, I don't think that anything is going to change in politics until we somehow stop the corporations from owning us. They are running our country. They're telling us what to do. They're penalizing and moving the whole political conversation away from what really matters, and they're getting us to fight with each other instead of realizing what is really going on here. So until we limit their power, we're going to keep spinning our wheels. It's just going to be a waste of time. And I think everybody in this country is so frustrated with the fact that we are not going anywhere, and that people are getting very angry about it. That's where this anger is coming from. It's a feeling of helplessness amongst all the public citizens. I know that's the way I feel.
Sean?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how to respond to that. I frequently hear people, and certainly in my conversations here, talk about the corporations that are running everything, and I just don't know what that means. And I say that because there's some companies out here that are, first of all, look, the United States is a capitalist economy, right? And we have been for the better part of our history, and we've done pretty well as a consequence. And there's some good companies out there, and there's some lousy companies out there. But I'm pretty darn proud of the fact that that Google is an American company. I'm pretty delighted that Apple is an American company. I'm not sure when someone sort of offers a blanket statement about corporations what that really means. I mean, there's an awful lot of small business people who've incorporated themselves. Are they evil? I don't buy that. I do think that it's going to be critical for all of us to figure out. I think your listener is exactly right in the sense that she wants to see the country move forward. I think the way that we do that is we really have to have serious debates about the issues. Where do we want the country to go? What kind of country do we want to live in? What kind of values do we want to honor? And that's something that, the only way that that ever happens, this is perhaps the simplest piece of political advice I can offer people, but it's perhaps the most profound because I know it has impact. Talk to your congresspeople. Call them up. Send them a letter. Write to your senator. Write to your congressman. There's an awful lot of public service, and we're working pretty darn hard, and their staffs here in Washington as well. I mean, I think the other thing we should remember is not only is Gabby Giffords fighting for her life, and obviously we're wishing her well, but one of her staffers lost his life, and obviously yes. There were a number of folks who just by virtue of the fact they were walking through a parking lot at the Safeway lost their lives. There are many folks who are also injured and recovering now. There are a lot of folks in Washington who come here, and the thing that brings them here is service. It doesn't mean that the conversations don't occasionally get tangled and nasty and uncivil, but by and large, on an individual basis, if you were to talk to any person who moved here from some part of the country, perhaps from Wisconsin, their stories probably begin with, I wanted to help, I wanted to make a change.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's go back to what you started with, too. We spent some time yesterday talking about the dire straits that many people find themselves in. If you don't have a job and you can't pay the bills and you don't have health insurance and you're really struggling, and a lot of people are, we have such a high unemployment rate, it seems to me as though it's natural, if not, it's not a good reaction necessarily, but understandable that you would say, hey, I'm really mad about this, and I'm mad at so-and-so about this, and I shouldn't be in this situation. It's your fault that I'm in this situation, and in many cases, it is somebody's fault that sure. They don't have a job. You got to have work.
Yeah. Yeah, look, we have an employment problem in this country. It is the singular problem that should be animating everybody here in Washington, jobs is the number one issue. And that's why, as I say, that we're constantly focusing on how do we create economic growth, because economic growth will obviously create the opportunities to create more jobs. I'm going to offer something up that's counterintuitive, and I certainly hope that I don't draw any ire from your audience. I mean well by it. But I think we need to remember when we look at the unemployment rate, and obviously it's different around the country and it's different amongst demographic groups, but one of the things nationally that we look at is that we're at about 9.4%, I think, if I'm quoting the latest numbers accurately. One of the things that we call full employment in this country, which means people who are unemployable, is usually when we get down to about 4.5% to 5% unemployment, we generally say we're at full employment. So while that number, 9.4%, seems really high, and it is, and trust me, I have family that's been out of work for over a year. I have dear friends who've been out of work for over a year. These are smart people, folks who went to West Point, served their country, and they ought to be working. They ought to be contributing sure. to society in a productive way. Anyone that want to be working. The reality is, I think we all get fixated on that number, and I'm not sure that it's actually as telling as it ought to be. We definitely need to see an opportunity for folks who want to work to find a job. And I think folks here in Washington are really struggling to figure out how that's going to happen. I don't want to say to people, gosh, you know what, just be patient, because frankly, I don't think it's easy when you don't have a job, you don't have income coming in, you have bills coming in, to say, I can be patient. But unfortunately, economic cycles don't turn around in 6 months. I think we're a society that's used to sort of instant gratification, and I'm afraid we were all party to putting ourselves in this position. We wrote some checks that we just weren't able to cash over the course of the last, two decades. And certainly some of our national policies contributed to that. We spent money we didn't have, both in a national level as our government and certainly as consumers. Many of us did that. Unraveling that and putting us back on sound financial footing is going to take some time. And it's not going to be without pain for people. Trust me when I tell you, I am incredibly empathetic to those folks. Mm-hmm. I'm related to them, and I'm friendly with them.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, thanks for the call. Our number, 800-486-8655. Sean Gibbons, Director of Communications for Third Way, is our guest this hour. It is an organization that Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is honorary chair of, and they are working to find moderation. They are a think tank in Washington, and they are involved in a number of different issues. They have policy statements, and they get together to come up with various policy decisions and also to spur the conversation on moderation, which they are very much involved in this week, as Congresswoman Giffords was concerned about since the time she was first elected to the Arizona legislature. We go to Scott next in Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. And I'm going to be the first to commend your guest for the thought of a third way and also with the No Labels movement. I'm definitely to the right of center, but I believe in civil discourse, and we should all respect.
And I'm going to commend you on the Packers win.
Opinion. the problem I have is I think, and this weekend it was on display, we have a complicit media was out to demonize one particular side, and it was on display fully this weekend with the visceral attack on Republicans, Tea Party, Sarah Palin, anybody to the right of center. And I'll just use a couple of examples. Nancy Pelosi, who, like her or not, you can talk to Paul Ryan, you can talk to many people. She had no interest in working with Republicans. The press on her is usually pretty good. You know, Newt Gingrich was the Gingrich who stole Christmas on the cover of Time magazine. I mean, we seem to have a complicit media that really wants to demonize one particular side. I mean, let's be serious. Have you ever heard a positive article on the Tea Party ever? I mean, it's always a demonized thing. And so it's hard to have this third way. It's hard to have these no labels. It's hard to have civil discourse when it appears, and it's more than just appears, that the media is extremely complicit and engaged in picking a particular side and fomenting the problems and the hate speech and the animosity towards a particular group that, I mean, let's face it. I mean, I'm a conservative, so I'm a bigot, a homophobe, a racist, a sexist, you know, a misogynist. I mean, those are the labels that are placed on us, and you hear it. We hear it daily, and that's very difficult to actually want to have a constructive conversation when you go to the table and that's what people think.
Sean.
Well, I appreciate your comment. I guess I would say to that, one thing that we're doing right now is Kathleen is hosting a conversation where you and I are able to exchange ideas and views, and we need more media like this, to my mind, that we can all actually have a conversation. It doesn't happen in sound bites. It's not 7 seconds long. That's a challenge for us. We live in an age now where I don't know about you, but an awful lot of information that I consume is little more than a headline that I glance at on an email, and sometimes I find that actually, I'm ashamed to say this, but I'm satisfied that I actually understand what's going on. I think we all as citizens really have to use the media. It's a tool for us, and the media that you consume is, it's almost like the food that you eat. If you eat nothing but junk food, you're probably not going to be the healthiest person. If you consume nothing but junk media, and let's be honest, they're out there. There are different kinds of media out there. Some are better for you than others. If you consume junk media, you're probably going to come up with a series of viewpoints that may not be as accurate or as thoughtful as perhaps you might hope. So I think we all have to be mindful that at the end of the day, the media is just a tool. We are consumers of media, and we really probably individually have to make more of an effort to try to ensure that that we support and engage with the kinds of media that we like and we think are actually doing a good job. You know, I in a previous life worked at ABC News and worked at CNN, and I can tell you from working in those places, the folks who work there are genuinely interested in trying to present information in a fair and accurate way. They really are. And one of the first things you receive that I received at both of those organizations was a giant book of standards and practices that suggested that you ought not to show bias and that you really needed to strive to present balanced views and accurate reporting. And frankly, there was comeuppance to you if you didn't do those things. So I don't know that we can paint the media accurately across the spectrum by just sort of saying the media is to blame. But I completely agree with you that some of the information that's out there today is just trashy. It's not good. Yeah. And don't eat it, is I guess what I would tell you.
But people, I mean, that's a tall order to get some of the media outlets to change the way they operate, because they have an established audience, and if you tune them in and you find that it's not as rabble-rousing as what it used to be, if it's more calm, civil discourse, you kind of lose the audience, don't you? A lot of these branches of media make money on the fact that they get people riled up.
I think that's totally true. I think that we have a fractured audience, and I think as a consequence on some levels, we have a fractured country. People are able to, I mean, even just some of the major technological innovations, you can literally dial up your web server in the morning to deliver news to you from sources that you want. So that you can literally say, I only want to know about the Green Bay Packers, and I only want to hear about how to make the perfect meatloaf, and I only want to get information about these particular politicians, and I only want to get them from these sources. And that's great that people can really have the opportunity to make those choices, but it also, I think there's a danger in sometimes. I don't know about you, but I sometimes am the guy that runs first to the dessert tray at a buffet. So it's really critical that sometimes people make the conscious decision, I'm going to have some broccoli too.
Oh, now you got me thinking about dessert.
I'm sorry.
What will my dessert be today? We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Sean Gibbons is our guest, Director of Communications for Third Way. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The group has many aims. One of the reasons that we went to them is because Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is honorary chair of Third Way and has been concerned about how people come together to talk about contentious issues. This group is... part of their mission is to make service to country transcend partisan politics. Thank you, Scott, for your call. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl is our guest, hour number two of the program. If you want a suggestion of a book, or if you have a book that you would like to let people know about, Nancy is one of our favorite guests, and she just was honored with Librarian of the Year. So that's coming up, hour number two. And while we're talking about books, we have a huge book. This book is almost 1,000 pages long. I'm working on it. It's Ron Chernow's book on Washington, George Washington, A Life. Very well done, and of course, worth our examination. So that's tomorrow at 10 o'clock. We go back to phone calls for Sean Gibbons. Robin in Appleton is next. Hello, Robin.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wondered if what he would think of this idea. Very often I think that the conversation gets heated just because of the way it's structured. When people talk to each other, sometimes they just get heated. I'm a recently retired educator, and we have used for many years a process that's different, where people sit down in mixed groups and are given, let's say, a question, something like a series of questions, what would be the best outcome or what would be the worst outcome? And then as a group, go around and you know, give ideas so that everybody's ideas are heard, and everybody's, you know, is very gracious and listening to what everybody else has said. I guess one of the things that bothered me about the conversation that seemed to be happening during the healthcare issue last year was the way that people would go to these meetings and shout and listen and not listen to each other. And I think that, you know, if they use a process more like this, you really wouldn't have much choice but to listen.
Yeah, that's a great idea. The shouting matches bothered me too over an issue that concerns health care, concerns keeping us alive and keeping us healthy. That's an interesting idea, Sean.
Robin, I love that idea. I think it's a terrific idea. Not to sort of piggyback on that, but one of the things that we suggested in the letter that we sent to the leadership of the Congress was that Congress set aside funds to actually take at least one, if not two, bipartisan retreats for each chamber. So ideally twice a year, senators from both parties would get together, go away from Washington and away from the public eye and away from the press, and sit down and break bread together and perhaps do a series of exercises like the ones that you're suggesting. And maybe it's on some of the pressing issues before us, like how could we actually overcome an issue like climate change? What could we do as policymakers to actually fix that? Too often, I think the conversations that occur sometimes in the daily drive here in Washington is driven at the staff level, and sometimes, believe it or not, the staff are much more partisan than the members are. So we think that there might be a lot of value in actually offering people an opportunity to sort of step back and actually have these conversations and get to know one another in a way that perhaps isn't possible in the course of daily work. I don't know about your previous employer, Robin, but I certainly get the opportunity to take retreats with my colleagues here at Third Way, and it's something that I value a great deal. I think it's super helpful.
Mm-hmm. We don't do that. We should do that sometime. Robin, thanks for the call. Anne in Madison, hi.
Hi. I think you have two issues here. One is civility, and the other is where does it all come from? And American-style civility is sort of to smile while you're seething inside and saying that other person is a real blankety-blank. It's vapid. It's insincere. A better kind of civility is the kind you find in parliaments around the world, not in our Congress, you know, where I don't think four-letter words are common, but in the English Parliament, someone will stand up and say, the honorable gentleman from Sussex knows perfectly well that this labor bill is going to destroy the people of the Commonwealth or something like that. But it's polite, but it's pointed. And the fact is, as I think your caller Sandy said a few calls ago, both parties are serving the rich. They're serving corporate America. So these differences are really, they're kind of phony anyway. They're just for the public. So Democratic voters think the Democrats are on their side when they haven't been acting. As if they're on their side, their actions show otherwise. And, you know, all our politicians are accountable to the people. The people pay every penny of their salaries that they don't get from bribes. And if they all serve the people, I don't think there'd be any incivility because everybody would be, you know, fat and happy and satisfied that their politicians were not corrupt. But everybody nowadays knows that that's not the case. And it leads people like Rush Limbaugh, you know, who really should have been sued for slander many times, to stir up people and get paid by these huge corporations to do it.
Sean.
Anne, I thank you for calling in. I have a feeling if you and I went out to lunch, we would find we agree on a lot of things. But with all due respect, I just don't know that I agree with what you just said. I will own up to the fact I am a Democrat, and I'm proud of it. And I'm proud of some of the things that have happened here in Washington. Am I satisfied? No. I think there's a tremendous amount of work that has to be done. It's one of the reasons I get up and go to work every day, is to put my shoulder against that stone and try to push it up the hill. But we passed health care reform. That has been an 80-year project of our country, Republicans and Democrats alike, by the way. Folks on both sides of the aisle have tried to deal with this issue. Are we done? No. I'm concerned about some of the conversations about repealing the bill. I actually think we need to do more to improve it and work on some of the cost controls. But I'm really proud of the fact that that happened. My wife and I just recently had a baby girl. She's from in America where we have health care reform, and everybody has access to health care. That's pretty, you know, I don't want to curse, but that's pretty tremendous. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that we've had a conversation about financial regulatory reform. Have we done enough? No. But I like the idea that my mother, who's getting a little bit older, has some protections for her credit card that she didn't have before, and there might be a less likely opportunity for someone to take advantage of her. I think that that's a good thing.
All right, let's try to go to one more phone call. At least we're running short on time. Maybe two, if we can do it. Rodney from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. A lot of what I've been hearing is the media and people saying, oh, that they're fighting among each other. People need to stop calling people like Keith Olbermann, Glenn Beck, the press. They're just commentators. I'm a big Keith Olbermann fan, but I don't go to him to get my news. Like I said, I go to different websites because I learned that CNN, every time they report something for 10 minutes, then they got to have an issue about it left or right. So even if it's 1 plus 1 is equal 2, they got to find somebody that says 1 plus 1 equals 3.
Mm-hmm. The role of commentators, Sean.
I think your caller is exactly right. Is it Rodney? Is that correct?
Yes.
Rodney, I think that that if you turn on prime time, particularly in the cable universe now, what you find are hosts that are ostensibly giving you the day's news, what's happened in the country. But I think we all know, as we certainly hope we all know, that we're not listening to Walter Cronkite anymore.
I know. I miss Walter Cronkite.
I miss Walter Cronkite.
You do too.
I grew up on him. It's one of my fond memories from childhood. And I think that that's a real challenge for folks is, look, so many of us get information from so many different sources at all different times of the day, and it's really hard sometimes to parse who's giving this to me, where's it coming from, what's the agenda behind it. And as I said earlier, you know, there are some really tremendous folks who are working in journalism who are trying to offer people information that will help to elevate the conversation.
Right. Sean, we're out of time. Thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again. It was a very interesting hour.
Happy
Thanks.
To do so. Thanks for having me.
Sean Gibbons, Director of Communications for Third Way. That organization is an organization that Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is honorary co-chair of. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks for your calls.